It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin's legislature voted in March to create a state-appointed mental health board in Milwaukee. Governor Walker made his final two appointments to that board last Friday. We'll look at what's next for Milwaukee's current dysfunctional system.
First, we've seen a number of high-profile rulings from the United States Supreme Court over the last week or so. And while their business is now done for the term, Wisconsin Supreme Court is gearing up to release some big rulings of their own.
Over the next few weeks, the court will be issuing rulings on Act 10, voter ID, and same-sex partnership benefits, just to name a few. All eyes will be on the justices as they have the final say on some of the biggest legal battles of the last few years.
Joining us now to talk about the cases being considered is Patrick Marley. He's the Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For with fellow Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So the Wisconsin Supreme Court has a lot on their plate this term. They're a little bit slower than the Supreme Court at the federal level. And you're expecting decisions to be coming out over the next several weeks. But how big are some of these lingering decisions left on the plate there?
Well, you mentioned the three most important ones that they have left to decide. That's Act 10, the labor limits that Governor Walker put in place in 2011. That's been challenged by some unions. Voter ID, they've got two cases on voter ID that they're considering. And then they've got the same-sex partnership law that Democrats passed in 2009 after the state banned gay marriage. They created a registry that couples could get some of the benefits of marriage if they registered at counties, and that's been challenged as violating the state's ban on gay marriage.
Well, I want to start with the Act 10 case. We've seen some legal ping-pong on this, challenges to Governor Walker's signature piece of legislation. What is the court looking at here? What remains?
So Act 10 has been faced a lot of legal challenges. It was passed in 2011. It largely eliminated collective bargaining for most public employees in the state. It was challenged twice in federal court, and both times the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals upheld it. Act 10 was also challenged in state court on a theory that lawmakers had violated the open meetings law in passing it. The state Supreme Court rejected that a few months after the law was passed and allowed it to go into place. Another challenge, the one that's pending now, was filed in state court on the argument that Act 10 violated workers' constitutional rights to free assembly and equal protection under the law, saying that union workers were treated worse than employees who did not choose to be in a union. A Dane County judge agreed with them in 2012 and said that key parts of Act 10 violated the state constitution. That has now worked its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will decide whether Act 10 can continue as it is or if it's in violation of the Constitution.
Do you have any sense of the outlook here? Largely, Act 10 has been upheld, except for this piece, which is moving up the courts. What are you expecting?
Well, the court gave a little bit of a clue earlier because in this litigation became quite complex because the judge had ruled in favor of the unions, and this question was created as to whether the ruling applied just to the unions who had sued or to all unions in the state, and the state's Employment Relations Board continued to apply Act 10 to other unions, and another union intervened and said to the judge, these board members are in contempt of court because they're applying Act 10 after you've declared it unconstitutional. And the judge did issue contempt charges against Governor Walker's appointees to the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. That issue came up to the Supreme Court along with the underlying case, and within 10 days of the court hearing oral arguments, it issued a 5-2 decision undoing the contempt of court order and allowing the Employment Relations Commission to sort of continue doing how it had been interpreting Act 10 for other unions. So that perhaps gives us a sign of where the court is leaning on the merits of the case, though they haven't actually addressed the merits yet.
Well, so should the court rule against Act 10, would it be possible that collective bargaining would be reinstated broadly?
If it would be a very big win for the unions if they were to win before the Supreme Court. They would get many things back, but they would not get as much back as they had before Act 10 was put in place. There are elements of Act 10 that would still be in place. I think there would be a lot of questions as to how, I mean, we're going to have to see what the court does. If the unions do succeed before the court, I would not be surprised to see other litigation, either from unions trying to gain more or from opponents or supporters of Act 10 who would want to limit whatever the Supreme Court might do.
Well, we're going to move on now to another big issue. This involves the voter ID law, which has also seen lots of legal back and forth over the past few years. The newest wrinkle here involved a federal judge's recent ruling about the state's ID requirement. What do we expect here on that front?
So this is very complex because of the competing litigation, so to speak. The state passed in 2011 a voter ID law requiring people to show ID at the polls, and four lawsuits followed, two in federal court, two in state court. And as you mentioned, the federal judge recently ruled that it violated the U.S. Constitution. And so that is being appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Voter ID cannot be in place unless and until the appeals court or the U.S. Supreme Court were to overrule it. Meanwhile, we've got this these state challenges with two Dane County judges in separate litigation ruling that it violated two different aspects of the state constitution. One of those was reversed on appeal, but the other one remained in place, and those are before the state Supreme Court. So if the state Supreme Court were to say that voter ID was okay under the state constitution, that would be a win for Governor Walker and other supporters of voter ID laws, but it would not put the law back in place because of the judge's ruling in the federal case. In short, supporters of voter ID would have to win all four cases. If they lose any one of the four, then they don't get voter ID.
So the likelihood that this would be in place by the November elections, that's looking difficult right now.
That is diminishingly small because at the pace at which the federal court is going to move, it would be highly unlikely that they would rule before November. So I think that, it's hard to say never, especially in state politics in Wisconsin in the last few years, but it seems very, very unlikely that it would be in place for the November 2014 elections.
Another thing on the Supreme Court's docket, looking at a case involving benefits for same-sex partnerships. What's at stake there?
So this one is also a twist in this is separate federal litigation recently. U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb ruled that the state's ban on gay marriage violated the U.S. Constitution, and that ruling's been stayed, but her underlying finding is in place that gay couples could get wed. So if you can set that aside for a minute, what happened is in 2006, voters changed the state constitution to ban gay marriage and to ban civil unions, or what the way it's phrased in the Constitution, to ban any relationship substantially similar to marriage for same-sex couples. A few years after that, Democrats controlled all of state government, and they included a provision in the state budget that allowed same-sex couples to register at a county and then acquire some but not all of the benefits of marriage. They could get, like, hospital visitation rights, for instance. And the head of Wisconsin Family Action, which was one of the main forces lobbying for the gay marriage ban, challenged that in court, saying that the domestic partnership registries violated the state's ban on gay marriage and substantially similar relationships. That argument failed in county court in Dane County and before the appeals court, and now the state Supreme Court is reviewing it. We'll see what they have to say.
All right, and we're going to cover one last thing here before we go. The court also has a few cases in front of it that have to do with the John Doe investigation of Governor Walker. Now, this is not something that the Supreme Court in Wisconsin needs to wrap up in the next few weeks, but what is expected there?
So the court finishes its work on June 30th, which was yesterday, and that's sort of for their normal term. They take cases throughout the year, and then they try to finish them on June 30th. And then they sort of dribble them out over the next few weeks after that. And today the Chief Justice, Shirley Abrahamson, released a statement saying that the court had, in fact, finished all its work and in the next several weeks would be issuing its decisions. But the court all the time has cases come to it that it has to decide whether to take or not to take. And three of those cases are related to the John Doe investigation of Governor Walker. The court hasn't said what it's going to do, and we don't know when it will say that, but it is sort of not on the usual timeline of other cases. So the court could act this afternoon, or the court could act 3 months from now or 6 months from now in deciding whether to even take the cases.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that and all the rest of it. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Patrick Marley, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For with fellow Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein.
This past March, Wisconsin's legislature voted almost unanimously to remove control of the Milwaukee County Mental Health System from the county board. The new legislation instead called for the creation of a state-appointed board of medical professionals and others to run the system.
The decision came after decades of reports of dysfunction in the system, including sexual assaults, deaths, and an inability to create long-term treatment programs for patients.
Last Friday, Governor Walker named the final two members of the new 13-member Milwaukee Mental Health Board. He missed the June 9th deadline to name those appointees. Joining us now is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Health and Welfare investigative reporter Meg Kissinger. She led the paper's investigation of the mental health care system there that led to this ongoing overhaul. Meg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So Governor Walker's deadline on these appointees was earlier this month. He hit those a little late. Did he give reasons for that delay?
He didn't. He actually kind of took umbrage at my even asking about that and said that he had named a quorum. It was sufficient for a quorum, but some in the mental health community saw it as a little bit of an affront. You know, there's a lot of excitement and expectation and hope riding on a board that is staffed with medical professionals and people with lived experience, and the expectation was that it would be launched with a little fanfare and not just dribbled out.
And do we have a sense of the direction that the state's trying to move the system by looking at who those 13 appointees are?
Well, they come by way of nominations. So these weren't folks that that the governor just capriciously chose. They are people who are on a list submitted to him from both County Executive Chris Abley, who had four nominations of four of the 13 board members, and then the county board that had five. And then the remaining numbers came from dedicated spots by various groups, including the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Mental Health Task Force. And so so these were people, everybody on that list is somebody well-known in the mental health community in Milwaukee.
As you described last time you were on, this board has its work cut out for it. A lot of problems in the mental health system. Everybody pretty much seems to agree with that. What is success for this new board down the road?
So that's a great question. I think that success looks like real and substantive change and not the same old, same old. And, as we have reported time and again, 30 years or more of lip service, really, to improving conditions for people with mental illness and, promises unkept. And as we wait for changes in that, the clunky old structure of Milwaukee County's mental health system, groans on and chewing up, within, our patients really suffering. And conditions at the complex have deteriorated. Years ago, they gave up accreditation, et cetera. We've, documented all along the failures. And so there's just, a lot of hope. And so success, from my way of thinking, looks at substantive change, and in particular, moving it away from this very institutionalized structure relying on an institution to mental health in the community.
And again, as you described last time, the priority over the last few decades has been hospitalization, in effect, institutionalization of people with mental illness. The move, the priority, it sounds like, is to go to more community treatment programs, community residential programs. Is that a priority for this new board?
Yes. And that has been a problem everywhere, really. We can't claim sole ownership of that awful situation, because universally across the United States, you know, this when institutions began to shut down, and a lot for very good reasons, the promise was that care would be delivered at mental health centers based in neighborhoods, and that just didn't happen. Those weren't built, and for a lot of reasons. And so, so that is where the focus will be now. And, you know, a lot of things are happening concurrent to that. So just today begins, you know, mental health parity nationally. And so, you know, as a part of the Affordable Care Act, the promise is, you know, health care for all, regardless of the ability to buy insurance, and that includes mental health conditions.
There's been some controversy from the labor angle on this, moving away from that mental health complex, unionized jobs. The legislators behind the legislation we're talking about say it would allow outsourcing, going away from union jobs. What's the current state of affairs on that?
Right, and I think that this is a situation that doesn't fit into a very tight box on that question. So, in other words, you know, the labor unions that work very hard to keep jobs for their members, you know, have a vested interest in both keeping the hospitals running, but, you know, no one is too cynical, or I hope not, that unions are just fighting back, you know, pushing back on closing the hospital for the sake of saving jobs, because certainly there are jobs, good jobs to be had, you know, in the community. And so, you know, people's... The motivations I want to believe are not altogether selfish on either side, you know, or shouldn't be. I mean, the central question should always be what is the best for the health, you know, the mental health of patients.
And union members have raised safety concerns. If the complex, the mental health complex, is closed or downsized too quickly, you don't have enough staff to deal with the patients who are still there.
Right. And you know, I think that is a very important role for them to play, to ask the hard questions. Okay, we have, so for example, at the mental health complex in Milwaukee County, we have long-term care units. And just to understand, you know, so that your listeners know, I mean, these are not people who are going through mild depression, not to minimize the effects of mild depression, but we are talking about people with very deep-rooted and wide-ranging disabilities that need great structure. And so you can't simply say, okay, we're downsizing and good luck out in the community. There needs to be a guarantees, you know, that people are being placed in settings, in homes that have that can be scrutinized and inspected, and we can and society can check their well-being.
As this change happens, who pays for it, and is it going to be more or less expensive from what we know now?
Well, those,
huge question, I know.
Yeah, right, right. Who pays for it? A lot. You and I, both in terms of county dollars, state dollars, federal dollars, and then, you know, for people that have private insurance, which almost nobody in the population that we're talking about, you know, people with real profound both developmental and mental health worries or issues, they are not going to have most likely private insurance. So, yeah, it's public dollars that we're talking about.
And briefly, I've heard there might be a shortage of key professionals, maybe psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and others to ease this transition to community care and treatment. Is that true?
Yeah,
is that a problem?
That is the next big story in mental health. So as we transition, you know, from this institutional care into the community, what good is it going to do us if we don't have the doctors to supply the care? And, you know, as is well documented, child psychiatrists, that is the number one shortage in medicine today, are child psychiatrists. There is not a child psychiatrist north of Wausau in the state of Wisconsin. So you can have all the clamor, you know, you can have the great demand for care, but if you don't have the supply, we're in big trouble.
We'll leave it there for now, but probably check in with you again on this, I imagine. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Please do. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Meg Kissinger, talking about the progress in creating Milwaukee's new mental health board. She reported and continues to report the Chronic Crisis series, which led to this major overhaul. Almost everybody has a story about an animal that had a behavior they couldn't explain. Tail chewing, aggression, listlessness. Our next guest traces the history of mental illness in animals and says there's a lot we can learn about ourselves by understanding what's going on in the minds of animals.
Laurel Breitman joins us now. She's written for The New Inquiry, Pop-Up Magazine, and Orion. She's the author of the new book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you start out with the story of your Bernese Mountain Dog, Oliver, and the day he jumped out of your fourth-floor apartment window. What happened that day?
Oh, it was heartbreaking. We left him alone, my ex-husband and I, just for about a day and a half with a human that he really loved, our downstairs neighbor. And we'd have been gone only about 2 hours, and his caregiver went out to go to the farmer's market. And as soon as Oliver realized he was alone, he went into a huge panic. And he ended up pushing the window air conditioning unit in our kitchen out of the way. He chewed and clawed a hole through a metal window screen, somehow held the sash open, and then he jumped out of our apartment.
Oh, it's amazing that he was able to do that, which shows the anxiety that he was going through. And this was your first really big incident, sounds like, with Oliver, who was anxious, he was destructive and compulsive. How did you deal with this host of issues that he had?
We tried everything. We came back from that wedding as fast as we could, and we went to find him at the vet clinic. And I was so sad and confused and not sure what to do next. And I asked the attending veterinarian what to do, and he looked at me and said, move to a first-floor apartment. And then he gave me a prescription for Valium and Prozac. Not for me, for Oliver.
That's what launched you sort of on the journey of this book. You were baffled because you couldn't ever really figure out what Oliver was feeling. You couldn't ask him, which brings up the question, how do we ever figure out what's going on in the minds of animals when it comes to their mental health?
Well, it's always going to be a mystery. But, you know, what I realized while researching this book was it's often a mystery, even with our human family members and the people we're dating. You know, just because you ask someone that you're in a relationship with how they feel doesn't mean that they can tell you. They may not even have words for their feelings themselves. And that's what actually underlies so much of psychotherapy. So it's not actually that much of a stretch to use observation to try and understand emotional thunderstorms or turmoil in other creatures, as long as you're a careful observer and you don't overproject, or as long as you, how should I say, you don't see exactly what you already think you're looking for. I mean, you have to be pretty open-minded, and you have to know the normal baseline for the creature at hand. So that's why so many of us see these things in our pets, is because we know them really well, and so we know what their normal is, and so we can tell when they seem depressed or compulsive, for example.
So you're getting at a term that's been sort of a dirty word in science for a long time, anthropomorphism, the idea that we project human behaviors and motivations on animals. And you say that we've inherited a bias against identifying with other animals that isn't useful, and it's high time we discard it. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that as human animals, trying to understand the motivations or the feelings behind the behavior in other creatures, we have to project. You know, we will always be a human animal imagining what it's like to be another animal. It's impossible to think about your dog without thinking about your dog in human terms. You know, we use human language to describe what they do. We have human feelings. That's really the only thing we can do. You can't take your brain out of your head and put it in a jar and use it to think about other animals in a somehow unbiased fashion. So I think that we can either anthropomorphize well or we can anthropomorphize poorly. And I'd like to see us anthropomorphize well, because when you're guessing about the emotional state of an animal that you know really well, you're probably right.
Darwin was at the vanguard of the idea of animal emotions. What did he have to say about this?
He believed other animals could be insane. He thought that other animals didn't go insane as often as humans, which is interesting. But he thought other animals, and I mean other animals across the board, really, from chimpanzees to horses to some rodents, he believed that all of us experienced emotions. The only thing that he believed that other animals didn't experience was shame. And I think that that's actually a function of his time in the Victorian period. People were busy feeling guilty about a lot of things.
Well, you tell a story about a chimpanzee named John Daniel who was adopted by a London family, and his rich and complex emotional life, on the outside, you know, it sort of seemed to parallel what a human child might have felt. Can you tell us about him and what happened?
Sure. John Daniel was basically kidnapped in the Congo in the 19-teens. I'm not exactly sure what year. No one is. And he was sent on a ship to London, where he was purchased by a department store to be a display and what the department store owners would hope would be a really good Christmas present for someone, and kept in the front of the department store. And he was purchased by a woman and her uncle, and he was raised like a human child inside of a London home. And he did things like play the drums. He ate jam on toast every day. He poured tea for himself. He put trash in the trash can, and he had lots of human friends. And he was actually the first gorilla that really showed the Western world that gorillas weren't bloodthirsty brutes, but that they were affectionate vegetarians. Because before that, the only gorillas people knew were gorillas they ran into when they were hunting them. So, of course, they were aggressive. But John was a sweet, emotional creature who was a lot like a person.
And what happened to him in the end?
Well, John was growing, and you can't keep a male silverback gorilla in downtown London, even
silverback
if they are
gorilla.
Really nice.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, his humans needed to find somewhere else for him to go, and they thought that they were giving him to a sanctuary where he would live out his life in a peaceful garden. But instead, it turns out that they were giving him to Ringling Brothers Circus. And Ringling sent him to New York City, and they put him up in Madison Square Garden in a cage on display. And within 3 weeks of arriving in New York City, John had died of a broken heart.
That's so interesting, because hearing that story, you know, it sounds like a story of heartbreak. You can imagine this animal who was pretty much a family member, and then all of a sudden he's back to being objectified, being this animal without touch and companionship. So is it wrong to read his story like that?
Well, I mean, I use the word heartbreak because his death was front page news in the New York Times at the time. And his death unfolded in the aftermath of World War I, where the assumption was that lots of humans could die from heartbreak too, and homesickness. So that was considered a physical illness at the time that could weaken and kill someone. So people thought about homesickness then a little bit differently than they do now. And so I don't think it's unreasonable. Certainly that's what everyone around him thought. But also, you know, if we combine that with what we know today about depression and sadness, he also likely had a really weakened immune system. Who knows what he was exposed to on the boat on the way over? He was so sad he wasn't eating. All he did all day was scan the crowd for faces of people that he might know, according to observers. So he was definitely sad, and that affects our physiological well-being, and it's likely it made him suffer from something else too.
So you mention a silverback gorilla who dies reportedly of heartbreak and homesickness, and then your dog who was given Prozac and I think you said Xanax. What kind of overlap is there between human psychiatric medications and conditions and animals?
Well, really, there's so much. And what I learned really early on while researching all of this stuff was so much of what we know about the unhinged human mind, both how we diagnose and think about certain mental illnesses and also how we treat them, stems from our observations of other animals. So after Darwin, there was a move away from talking about these sorts of emotional states in other animals. It was seen as slightly less scientific. But at the same time, all of these creatures were inside labs, and we were doing things like testing our psychopharmaceuticals on them. We were doing behavioral studies to find out what happens. You know, if you ignore an infant rhesus monkey, turns out they don't turn into an emotionally healthy adult. They may not even develop cognitively in the ways they need to. So on the one hand, we can deny these things, and we have been, you know, for generations. because it seems in some ways or has seemed as sentimental. But on the other hand, they've been the most helpful proxies for understanding the human mind. So I think we've tacitly acknowledged these emotional states and disorders in other animals for quite a long time.
So does that mean the dam is bursting and we're, you know, opening the gate to allow animals into this area where all the emotions that we acknowledge as humans live?
I think that's true. You know, I think we're in this sort of golden age of flowering science around animal emotions. And in a lot of ways, it's a return to the late 19th century when Darwin and a lot of his colleagues were writing about these things. I don't actually think Darwin would have been surprised by a lot of what's going on today. You know, he didn't have an MRI machine to put his dogs into, but he did describe dejection and happiness in his dogs. So it's not, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. But how we're talking about these things definitely is. And it makes good scientific sense, frankly. You know, most mental illness in the United States are various manifestations of fear and anxiety disorders. And fear and anxiety is something that we share with most of the animal kingdom because it's healthy. It keeps us away from danger. The problem is when we get scared, and by we, I mean, you know, belugas and hamsters or humans, when we're not actually in a situation of danger, when we're panicking, even though everything's okay. And that's, I think, you know, when we tip into the territory of mental illness and normal life becomes difficult.
We're talking right now with Laurel Breitman. She is the author of the new book, Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you lived with an animal you might consider having a mental illness? Did you see what you might have called anxiety or depression? Do you think it's helpful to draw a line between the animal mind on one side, the human mind on the other? Or can we draw valuable lessons from blurring that line a little bit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Laurel Breitman. She's the author of the new book called Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. We're drawing that link between what's going on in the minds of animals and what it says about us as humans.
And we want to hear from you with your questions, maybe your experiences dealing with an animal, maybe a pet exhibiting signs of anxiety, depression, or other mental illness. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers right now. We've got Sherry with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. You know, my dog is a miniature pincher, and she's older. She's 11, and she also has diabetes, so insulin. She has to take insulin. But she started developing anxiety a couple of years ago. Now, she was always a high-strung dog, but it was, at first, I was very resistant to her taking medication, but she was miserable. I mean, she was sick. She was so nervous. You know what I mean? And nothing was calming her. No amount of walking, no amount of exercise, no special pheromone sprays, you know, nothing was working. And so now she takes the anti-anxiety medication. She is so much better. I actually posted on Facebook, you know, for people. I said, anybody out there who has anxiety, who, you know, is concerned about taking medication, if it, you know, if it does half for you what it did for this dog, then you shouldn't feel bad about taking it. She's not, you know, a zombie or anything. She's just better. Hmm. You know, she's not nervous and unhappy like she was. She's much better.
So that's transformed her life. Sherry, thank you so much for that call. Sounds a lot like your dog Oliver, at least with the anxiety. I don't think the medications worked for Oliver, but what do we know about how antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications work on animals?
Well, that story makes me so happy. I mean, I think as with humans, they can work. They can work spectacularly, but you really have to look at the individual animal's experience. And one anti-anxiety medication that works for one miniature pincher is not going to work for another one. And some animals will respond to the psychopharmaceuticals and others won't, and they'll just actually need more exercise or time with their humans. So, you know, if you know any person suffering from anxiety, no two people's anxiety is the same. We can draw some generalizations about what's helpful, but really you have to try all the tools at hand. And but the drugs are, they can be really helpful. You know, I get concerned when they're the first line, because oftentimes a creature's anxiety, just like a person, you know, is stemming from something in their environment or an unhealthy relationship in their life or not enough physical activity. But if you've addressed all of those things, then absolutely you should try psychopharmaceuticals.
And Laurel, you write that the orcas at SeaWorld take Xanax regularly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how regularly, but definitely when they've removed calves from the mothers and the mothers are suffering. And that's a case where I feel like the use of these drugs is unconscionable. You know, you shouldn't have to medicate an animal into compliance in a situation that is literally driving them insane. So these drugs can be deployed as tools, or they can be deployed in a lot of ways as they were in, you know, say, women in the 1950s as behavioral control. Mm. Where someone is being medicated into compliance with a system that's not making them happy. So using these drugs in display facilities for animals who are just miserable as display creatures, I think is more problematic. That said, you know, sometimes they can be used for a time to get a creature through a difficult spot, much in the way that, you know, say antipsychotics can be used for some people or other drugs. They can put a pause on your despair, your anxiety, long enough for you to be able to begin therapy. And then you can wean yourself off the drugs.
Let's go back to our callers now. Greg is with us from Manchas. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I'm a person who's been with animals for most of my life. I'm in my 60s. I've spent a lot of close contact with dogs and horses, and I can just tell you that there's this, you know, they reflect the same degree of emotions that humans. I don't think evolution spared a lot of the other higher animals from the same kind of general patterns. I've seen depression. I've seen anxiety. I've seen all sorts of different emotions on dogs and horses, and I've seen mourning and grief. I've seen all of those things, and I think it's a natural part for everybody, including animals. I remember seeing a squirrel after I shot another squirrel when I was a kid, and that squirrel came over and investigated the corpse of the one I had just shot, and then tried to move it, tried to rouse it, chattered at it, walked around it. It was amazing how much time that animal spent on it, and well, I stopped squirrel hunting after that.
Ah, interesting. Greg, thank you so much for your call and your experience of seeing all kinds of emotions is what he's talking about in the animal world. Do you think, Laurel, that's common if we look at it like that, that we do see the emotions if we're allowed to see them?
Absolutely. You know, feeling grief when we lose someone close to us is healthy. There's a reason we feel that, because it's the flip side of becoming close and having affection for those other animals that are good to us, that make our lives easy or more pleasurable. So it makes good sense, you know, that humans wouldn't be the only ones to feel emotional pain when we lose someone that we're bonded to. So a lot of this, it does make really good sense. You know, it's hard to admit for a lot of people, because it may force us to deal with other things in our lives, say our food system or the captivity industry, that are inconvenient. You know, we want to believe that we're the only ones, that we're special. And I think we are special. I don't think, say, a squirrel's depression is the same as a person's. But as I mentioned before, no two persons' experience of depression is exactly the same either.
So to move to healing, do animal minds heal the same way that human minds heal? Can we learn things from it?
We can absolutely learn things from them. And that was such a fun part of researching this book. So often people ask me, like, isn't this work so depressing, all this mental illness? I actually think the opposite is true, because I was just floored time and again by so many stories I saw, you know, of elephants cheering up other elephants, or sea lions distracting other sea lions from their compulsions, to dogs cheering up other dogs. And at the end of the day, I actually think humans are the best therapy animals, often for our animals. I often felt when I was walking with my own dog that I should be wearing like a therapy human vest, you know, because I was really dedicated to helping him move through the world. But honestly, most things that, particularly when it comes to domestic animals, most things that cheer up your dog are things that are going to cheer you up. More exercise, goofing around, playing tag or hide and go seek, spending less time on your phone and your computer, and more time running around. Sometimes psychopharmaceuticals, behavior therapy, new and healing relationships, structure. I mean, these are just bigger than any species, actually, the positive effects they have on us.
Well, you ultimately lost your dog, Oliver. I'm sorry to say, at the end of the book, you know, we find out that he doesn't make it. He has another incident while you're away. But for someone who does have an animal with problems like Oliver, you know, you're not an animal behaviorist, but what are some things that they can try?
Well, I think number one, they should stop feeling too guilty. I mean, I've spent the better part of a decade feeling bad about what happened to my dog, and I tried everything to help him, my ex-husband as well, and we couldn't. And I think that a lot of many hours, many years that you spend with a creature who's maybe a tad bit demented, you know, you feel bad and guilty and responsible. And so I think people should try everything that they can. You know, a lot of the things that we've talked about, they should seek the help of a veterinary behaviorist. You should educate yourself about the natural history of the animal you're trying to help and make sure that as many of their needs are met as possible. But then you should also just relax and realize that all of us are born into the world with various propensities to emotional thunderstorms. And there's only so much that we can do. And you can't love someone through everything, although you can try. And it's just so worth it to try.
Let's take one more quick call. We've got Lori on the line with us from Waterloo. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I was just wondering if you looked into the progressive practices that many shelters are using now to reduce stress in dogs that are kenneled, such as enrichment puzzles and play groups, and teaching the dogs self-calming behavior, such as go-to-mat skills.
All right. Thanks, Lori. Those are good suggestions. What about that, Laurel?
Those are fantastic. Yes, there are a lot of progressive shelters and rescue entities who are trying to do these things. You know, kennel madness, you know, that's not an official term. But that's something that happens. You know, you take an animal, you know, this especially can happen with cats. You take them out of a household where they know what to expect. They have a schedule. They understand the people around them. And you bring them to a shelter where it's loud and noisy and there's no smells. And, you know, the surfaces that their paws are on are completely different. And I think that's responsible for so much emotional distress and eventually behavior problems when they get adopted. So, yes, great shelters are changing all of these things, which is exciting and a wonderful development.
Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Laurel Breitman. She's written for The New Inquiry, Pop-Up Magazine, and Orion. She's the author of Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Can Help Us Understand Ourselves.